Welcome to How I Raised It, the podcast that goes behind the scenes with entrepreneurs who've raised capital. We uncover the tips, tricks, and techniques they use to get investors to write a check. Strap in and turn it up.
Hi, welcome to another episode of How I Raised It, produced by Foundersuite.com. Today I have Gregory Robinson of The Mom Project coming to us from a rainy Chicago. How's your day going, Gregory?
It's going well, all things considered. Thank you, Nathan. And thank you for having me.
Yeah, no, it's, I like to get, we've had a handful of Chicago startups on the show so far. I love to get like a diversity of business types, of geographic locations. I love to have it from all over. So glad to have a windy city. What is Mom Project? What do you guys do?
So the Mom Project is a digital talent marketplace and community that connects talented women and men with world-class employers that really respect work and life. And when we say respect work and life, it really comes down to two components. So some form of flexibility, you know, it doesn't have to mean fully remote, but, you know, understanding that, hey, maybe I need to drop off my kid before I get into the office. So my start is at 9:30. And the second is respect. And respect is a huge factor. You know, respect that you can bring up family in an interview and not feel prejudice. Respect that, you know, your manager and the executive team over you, you know, support that you equally prioritize your family to your work. And so we launched in April of 2016, based out of Chicago. And we've had a busy few years. In the just about 3 years since we launched, we've grown to have over 100,000 women on our platform, over 1,000 companies, and partnering with 50 Fortune 1000. So, you know, it's been a flurry of a year, but really exciting to get the business off the ground.
It's interesting. I'm seeing maybe a small trend of different job and work marketplaces. I just had a call 2 days ago with a company called Vengst that is a job market for cannabis industry. And here you are with kind of the talent marketplace for women, and pretty interesting how it's sort of splintering beyond the mega sites out there, right?
Well, I mean, if you think about the two types of work, there's, you know, full-time, which we all know well. I think it's what people usually think of when they think of having a job. But there's really part-time and contract-based work. And so the gig economy is a rising trend. So the idea that you work on a shorter scope or that you might be an independent contractor, more and more people are doing it. And it's not just people who work for Uber and DoorDash. You know, it's people who also work in professional sectors. But I think something that's interesting that people don't fully appreciate is that the gig economy has actually been a huge piece of our existing world for years. So it's just been hiding under a different name, and it's been hiding under this kind of staffing industry umbrella. So I think the stat is something about $120 billion of payroll passes through project-based work that is mostly controlled by these larger staffing companies. And, you know, and they control access to these jobs, and they've got great gig factors. But they just haven't been able to bring them to people. So you do exactly. So you see marketplaces now kind of seizing on this opportunity and seizing on their ability to communicate to a millennial and a more digital audience. You know, with that digital platform like the Mom Project, we have a site where you can go and create a profile very simply and be matched, you know, pretty smartly to opportunities. And that's just the way that, you know, people are preferring to engage now. So I think you're going to see, you know, our type of businesses grow and share, you know, as this millennial class kind of grows to be the biggest part of the workforce. And it already is 40% of the workforce today.
Very interesting. I guess was the original idea, or let's talk about the original idea. Was it you or someone you know that, you know, had kids and went off out of the job for a while? And I guess called the Mom Project.
Yeah. So the origin is actually quite interesting. So my background is from private equity. I worked at a firm called L. Catterton. L. Catterton's the largest global private equity fund focused on consumer goods. So they have companies like Peloton, you know, they used to own Restoration Hardware and Home Chef. So yeah, really, really just a great fund. And at the time, when I had my first son, Asher, my wife, Allison Robinson, who is the founder of the business, went on maternity leave. And it was in maternity leave when she was evaluating, you know, going back to work and what that would look like in conjunction with being a mother and balancing both of our careers, that she realized that there just weren't really scalable, solid solutions. So she kept on researching because she was a Procter & Gamble, you know, commercial executive who fed off of data. And she stumbled across a Harvard Business Review study that showed that 43% of college-educated women who have children off-ramp from the workforce. And this was really kind of a fundamental learning. When you look at, you know, how we're trying to expand our economy and, you know, try to create a lot of value from within, you know, this became a big opportunity that all these women were leaving. And so that was really the original insight that a lot of women were opting out, and we needed to be more thoughtful about, you know, just the topics of work around motherhood and, you know, how to make sure that they can have a kind of continuous experience or not have to take a step back if they choose to take a break for parenting. And so that was really the origin.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. It sort of resonates. I mean, you got the gig economy angle there, but it also sort of resonates, like you're talking about, with the work-life balance and respect with this thing I just heard of for the first time 2 days ago, the zebras. Do you know the zebra movement?
I don't. Please tell me.
It's pretty interesting. There's like, I think I saw an investor's, Cyan Bannister, sort of involved in it, or she was talking about it at least, where it's this whole like movement or trend to not just create unicorns, which are, you know, balls to the wall, scale as fast as possible, winner take all, but these zebras, which are a little bit more inclusive, sort of more focused on steady growth versus growth at all costs, a little more focused on like taking care of your employees instead of burning them out. Like it's this sort of different mindset for startups, building startups. I just literally stumbled on it like 2 days ago. I thought it was pretty intriguing. Sounds like you're sort of in that vein a little bit, right? Or
yeah, I mean, I can't wait to hear what the next zoo analogy will be, but so yeah, last year we grew about 300% year over year, and we're going to be growing another 300% or so this year. So you know, we've got these big tailwinds. So I think there are those unicorn dynamics of, you know, the cross section of two giant opportunities getting to best in class gender parity. By McKinsey's stats is a $2.1 trillion US opportunity. And that's not even full parity. That's just what they deem best in class. So when you look at just the, you know, re-entry or workforce participation piece, that's an $800 billion opportunity. You know, I don't know that many $800 billion untapped pieces of our economy there are left. And then, you know, the rising gig economy and companies understanding and attempt to integrate these into their workforces. And, you know, I believe that, you know, Facebook and Google are, you know, have almost equal, you know, headcount participation from gig workers as they do, or contract workers as they do from full-time staff themselves. So really the companies who are, you know, closest to the data and trying to, you know, be thoughtful about, you know, the trend of work are moving quickly. And I think a lot of people are following.
Yeah. On that note though, you know, Facebook is getting kind of skewered right now a little bit because they've got these content review contract workers that are making like $29K a year, whereas like your average Facebook employee is like $240K a year, right? You're sort of having this pretty huge delta between like the full-time employee and the contract worker. I don't know if that's something you can address, or is that part of the...
Yeah, funny enough. So we are actually an approved supplier for Facebook contract-based work. So I can speak to that. So I think, you know, there are cases where certain contractor classes may not be getting you know, the highest bill rate. But I think on average, and I can speak to the roles that we see, the compensation is very competitive. I think that, in fact, sometimes from an hourly perspective, it's higher than the salaried employees. And the reason that they do that is because, you know, when they do bring in contractors, generally they don't offer those full suite of benefits like stock options and, you know, and long parental leaves and paid time off. So in order to be competitive and have, you know, kind of really full-time contractors, which is what they shoot for, 6+ month projects, you know, you have to, you know, kind of balance the scale. So from my experience, and so that's one data point, you know, I found Facebook has actually been, you know, really, really good to work with.
Mm. Let's talk about that a little bit. And this is a broader sort of gig economy question, I guess, but like, you know, that's the rub, I think, against being a contractor or being in the gig economy is how do you deal with insurance? How do you get insurance for your family, right? If you're not employed, and benefits too, but like, do you guys solve any of that for the moms or the participants on the platform or what?
So we do. So we partner with a company called Stride. In our opinion, Stride is the best digital platform to source, you know, individual and family healthcare. Mm. And, you know, it really is interesting because, you know, healthcare used to be considered part of that kind of that welfare package. You know, when companies, you join a company and you'd be there 5, 10, 20 years, right? And there was a dynamic where, you know, they really were responsible for, you know, for taking you to retirement, right? And the reality is not that many people stay in a job for 20 years anymore, you know, and for our own benefit so that we can take opportunities to work at startups or to maybe change a location for a promotion. And you know, since the Affordable Care Act, you know, private insurance market really has gotten a lot better. And there are really great startups that are kind of getting into the space to do, you know, to provide ways for people to evaluate healthcare benefits. And so what we really feel like is, yes, it's great when an employer is able to provide you good healthcare, but really the benefit is that they're helping pay for it. They're helping pay for the premium. You know, they're helping, you know, create a class of people that hopefully get slightly better rates. And so it's more about the cost than say the access to good healthcare. So, you know, what we recommend is that, you know, take that cost into consideration in your bill rate. You know, so if you are if you are getting paid $50 an hour, you know, which roughly equates to about $100,000 a year person, you know, a $2.50 an hour, you know, bill rate adjustment, you know, more than, you know, compensates what a company would be providing for you, and then you can privately, you know, attain healthcare. So we really help people do that, and we help to curate kind of best partners in that continuum of care to make being a contractor really more feasible.
Got it. Great. And just in a kind of nuts and bolts way, how does it work? I guess if you're, you know, coming back to the workforce, you've got talent in finance or marketing, you post a profile, then I guess, are you charging companies or what's the business model?
Yeah. So it's free for all talent, right? So companies pay, and they basically pay when they perform, when there's a placement. So there's a markup, when there's a placement. So, what happens is people, you know, over half of the people who join our platform actually are word of mouth. So people hear from us or we, you know, we're in the news or we reach out to them directly about, you know, new opportunities with good brands, and they join the platform and they create a really basic profile. And this profile has kind of what you would expect it to have, you know, as far as, you know, what are my work skills? But, you know, it's really more conversational. You know, it's like, we like to say, what is your superpower? You know, kind of, you know, how do you like to describe yourself? It's less about this was my title as in this is what I think I'm quite good at. And then the other piece that makes us really more special is we work in work-life considerations. So, you know, what are your optimum, you know, number of hours a week that you want to work? You know, are there certain days that are considerations? You know, are you able to travel? Are you able to commute? And all of these factors, you know, basically build into the match algorithm. So when people on our platform are notified about opportunities, they're taken into consideration. So, you know, they're fairly well curated. And the interesting thing that we found, so when we launched the company, we thought this is a clear proposition for people who are trying to return to work, who don't really have tools or ways to do that, and we can help them do it. But what we found to be really interesting is about 70% of the people on our platform are currently in the workforce. And you know, what they're looking for is an employer that really gets it better, or potentially a more flexible situation, or you know, looking to work with best brands who identify with the mission. So you know, we have this, what I like to call, a really passive audience. You know, they are, you know, willing to kind of look at the roles that we curate. And so when they actually bid on something, they're bidding because it's motivated them in the way that it's different from what they're currently doing, which is pretty cool.
And then for companies, am I browsing talent profiles, or can I post a project and have people apply to it? What's the, that side of the equation?
No, that's a great question. So it's a project-based model. So our companies have accounts and customer success managers who help them create projects. And then when those projects are created, then it runs through the Match Science, which then invites people in our marketplace to apply to those roles. So, you know, in their dashboard, when people start applying, they'll be able to see, you know, the profile and the resume of the people, you know, that were curated for them. And we stack them by relevancy. So, you know, our match algorithm tends to be about 75% accurate. So that means, you know, 3 out of every 4 people who are hired are deemed a best match. And so sometimes we'll get, especially for a fully remote job, we could get hundreds of bids. So it's really important that navigate through all of that interest thoughtfully.
And as a company, am I paying just to post a project, or am I paying a percent? Nope.
Yeah, it's a markup. So it's a 20% markup. So so basically the way that it works is if we were paying the talent $50 an hour, then we would build a company $60 an hour, so that 20% markup. And for that, we handle all billing, all tax, you know, talent relations, and really just, yeah, help both sides navigate through this journey. I can say small businesses are really taking to it. So when I say small, I mean, you know, kind of under 250, because, you know, they may be able to offer more flexibility. You know, they may want, you know, to let somebody work 2 days from home on a 30-hour schedule, and in return, they get somebody who is more seasoned than the role. But that person is absolutely satisfied because they're getting engaging work, they're getting an opportunity for growth to work cross-functionally, and they're actually able to equally prioritize their family. So we find that it's a really great proposition for small businesses. That said, the biggest client base that we have is really Fortune 1000 enterprises, because when you step back from it, they really have the most roles. And if you look at the trends, you know, women are entering these companies in the workforce from college at parity. So actually about 53% of people placed in enterprises are women. But about 8 years in, right when they're reaching that manager director level, it drops to 35% women. And it's not shocking that corresponds exactly when, you know, women are having families, having their first or their second children.
Yeah, makes a lot of sense. It's the finance guy in me is sort of seeing it like an arbitrage opportunity, right? Which is probably your PE background is looking at it too, right? Yeah.
Look, I mean, there's a lot of feel good in it, but at the end of the day, these women are incredibly good at what they do, and they have tremendous economic value, right? And companies are desperate; they're hungry for this talent. You know, we've got, you know, in the professional sector, you know, the lowest rates of unemployment, you know, in recent history. You know, that means when people are filling full time jobs, you know, those roles sit open for longer than they've ever sat in the past 10 years on average. So, you know, you start to say, okay, look, if I can do a part-time permanent, you know, a 30-hour a week, you know, permanent role, or maybe I bring in a really highly skilled contractor for 3 to 6 months while we take our time to kind of get the full-time solution. You know, these, you know, it really starts to make a lot of sense.
Absolutely. Okay. Very cool. Sounds like a very clever business. Let's talk about raising money for this. How many rounds have you guys done?
Yeah, so we've done two rounds. We did our seed round at the beginning of 2018, which was a little over $2.5 million. And then in December of 2018, we announced our Series A, which was just about $8 million. So just under $11 million in total.
Excellent. And it looks like you started, let's go kind of chronologically. Did you go through an accelerator? I have something called Engage Ventures as an early investor. Yep.
Mm-hmm. We did not go through an accelerator. So yeah, that's a great topic as far as what really sets you up for success. So, you know, if you look at the money we've raised in the stage of the business, you know, I'm very proud. You know, we've raised just about $11 million in 3 years. But if you look at the timing of how we've raised that, we've really raised it all in the past, call it 15 months. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the first 2 years of the business, you know, we ran quite lean. And one of the reasons we ran lean is because, you know, we had the ability to founder fund for a period of time. But also Allison had, you know, a very strong background in enterprise sales. She headed up Pampers North America strategy. So she understood millennial mom just about as well as anyone on the market. Mm-hmm. Right. And I had this you know, professional finance background. So we, you know, we took the position that, you know, between us, we had that requisite kind of combination of skills to get the business off the ground, which we did. You know, when we came to market in April, you know, the Tribune wrote a cover of the business page story about us. You know, we were able to get enterprise businesses within our first 6 months. You know, the business had traction. But what I can share with the audience is that, you know, business traction and ability to raise funds in your first year aren't necessarily correlated.
Did you try and raise the money in those early days, or did you just kind of bootstrap it for a couple
of
years?
Yeah, you know, our plan was basically at the, you know, at the end of 16, early 17, you know, to raise an angel round, sort of kind of raise a small seed. So, and really what we encountered was a couple dimensions. One dimension is you really can't underestimate the first time founder weight that comes into play for investors, especially for early investors who are really making founder bets. Mm-hmm. And yeah, while some of it is, you know, you have to be from the right circles and you have to say things a certain way, there is an unquestionable difference between running a mid-sized business or a large business and being successful, and, you know, having the ability to kind of grit through and grow a business from nothing, you know, with triple-digit growth in a sustained way. And it's just so hard for them to evaluate whether you have that without runway. Another factor was, you know, our product is people. So we had an MVP, you know, so we had a decent technology, but, you know, not multi-million dollar investment in technology. And so, you know, depending on, you know, what your focus of your startup is, you know, if you're playing in a space like we were in marketplaces that are, you know, basically transforming the staffing space, you know, and your product is people, you know, these are things that, you know, make, you know, I call them, you know, venture investors who are predominantly technology investors a little weary. So we had a kind of a subject matter challenge. You know, we were a transformative marketplace, you know, focused on enterprise sales. So we had a people challenge. And then we also had an end customer. You know, so we saw early traction. We knew that it was real, but it is so hard for investors to qualify, you know, one, two, good contract, right? Because like $50,000 from an enterprise customer could quadruple your revenue in the first year, right? And make the growth chart look phenomenal. But, you know, on an absolute basis, it's not necessarily what it's going to take. So, you know, between, you know, being first-time investors and really having to kind of prove out in a space that isn't, you know, purely product-based, you know, it ended up taking a little bit more time than we anticipated. And there are pros and cons to that as well. So,
how long did it take you to raise that seed round? What's the time frame, roughly?
So I'd say just over a year and a half.
Yeah. And the list is an interesting list. I'm seeing names like Irish Angels and Atlanta Seed Company and Tech Square Venture Partners and some names I've never heard before. Maybe tell us how you assembled this list and like, what's the Irish Angel connection?
Well, so Irish Angels is actually Notre Dame's alumni investment fund and run by some incredibly smart women. It's a classic, school angel fund. Notre Dame is one of the best schools in the country, and in the Midwest, it is, it's just really an exceptional brand, right? So when we did start to, raise money in the Chicago ecosystem, we were lucky enough to kind of get them involved. Something interesting, though, about, the path to our funds is that some of our earliest commitments actually came from, what you would consider probably to be more corporate-backed funds than say, traditional tech funds. So Engage Ventures in Atlanta. So Engage is the first really Fortune 1000-backed venture fund. So LPs are, Delta and Home Depot and AT&T and Cox and Georgia Pacific, large players. And what they partnered with Tech Ventures to create Engage was really to, invest in businesses they thought were innovative, but really to support them, with their ecosystem. And then in a way, really, to kind of pick companies that they could envision using. So, some of our first dollars actually came from effectively, a group of, an investment committee that had a mix of venture capitalists, but also, kind of corporate strategics. And then we had BBG Ventures, which is a great seed fund run by Susan Lin, out of New York. And they're actually, they were previously owned by Oath. So in a way, we got kind of the corporate confirmation even before we got the traditional technology confirmation. But where I would say, go ahead.
But was that a strategy, or is that just what ended up happening? That's where you found buyers.
Yeah, I mean, it depends. It depends on how much credit you want to give yourself in retrospect, right?
Yeah.
No, I mean, I think and Allison, if you speak with her, you see that she really, is doing something special and understands, what she's solving for women in a unique way. And, but what ended up happening is that, these CEOs of these big companies have these diversity pledges, so there was these top-down commitments, and ultimately their businesses are still trying to work to meet these kind of giant targets like gender parity by 2025. So it was need that kind of created a relationship of mutual, benefit.
Okay, great. And what was there any unique element when you're pitching like Engage Ventures, which is the Fortune 1000? I guess is a lot of your pitch focused on how it can help them meet those, inclusion goals, or is it more just here's the business?
Yeah, I mean, I think more funds nowadays really do care about, what you're solving. So, you can look at what you're solving from a financial size of prize, but you can also look at what you're solving from a, a significance, what's this mean for us? Is this going to be, another convenience play, valuable convenience play, or is this something that can really, have a life cycle and improve the world we live in? So I think that factored in, but also the adjustable market. So, people who invest in marketplaces, people who invest in HR tech, they understand how work is transforming. And so they, the gig economy is just, it's just a major theme for a lot of funds. And, we live in a world that is more aware of the challenges, gender challenges, diversity challenges, ethnic challenges, handicap challenges, just more aware and more willing to be open about solving them than I think we've ever lived in. So that the general, trend to try to solve these problems has really played in our favor as well.
Okay, good. No, it's interesting. So fairly quickly, you raised the Series A of $8 million. Was that just opportunistic, or you had the growth and the investors coming in?
Yeah, it was growth. So we, from raise to raise, we grew about 350%. So and we were able to do it in a way that was, you know, a sustained month over month rather than, you know, kind of, you know, an elevator in 1 month. So, you know, it gave us the confidence to say, you know, and we had gone from really serving, while we can serve nationally, marketplaces care about something called liquidity, which is, you know, the balance of, you know, how many buyers and sellers you have. So, you know, we were really trying to be very thoughtful about when we were driving new companies into the platform, that we were driving them where we had the most people looking for work. And so at first that became Chicago. But then, you know, after the seed, we were able to really expand in equal ways to Atlanta and San Francisco. So once we had three markets that were really kind of performing well and we got those learnings, we felt like we were kind of able to take that step, to take that bigger investment and move on.
That's great. Yeah, kind of tangent on that. I guess, do you have to build an army of moms or women or candidates before you can go into a new market? Is that kind of the playbook?
You know, because so if you look at a staffing company, you know, they have to go open a physical office, right, to go try to serve a space, right? Mm-hmm. You look at a Robert Half, you know, in Chicago, they've got 32 offices with 5 to 10 mile radiuses around them for what they serve. So that model is dead. You know, at least that's my opinion. You know, I think the market is hot. You know, I think that, you know, unemployment is so low that, you know, the space is doing very well. But that's just not how skilled professionals, you know, engage with opportunities nowadays. Yeah. So, you know, that's my long way of saying it's, you know, we reach out to them on Facebook, we reach out to them on LinkedIn, you know, we're able to, you know, to kind of work through referral. So, you know, we were able to basically grow a market, you know, through just the digital social media and do it relatively quickly, which is an advantage for us so that we can evaluate opening markets or, you know, or following major customers in a pretty agile way.
Yeah, it makes sense. So putting together the Series A then, same kind of format, looks like, was it GrowTech is the lead on that or?
Yeah. So we had, Initialized Capital and GrowTech Ventures. So, Initialized Capital, our partner, lead partner on that is Alda Dean. Initialized Capital was founded by, Alexis O'Hanahan and Gary Tan. And then, GrowTech Ventures is just, you know, a great shop based out of DC, you know, very disciplined and opportunistic investor, really like the marketplace and the women's space. And we connected with them right away.
Yeah, cool. Did you pitch Alexis or Gary or other folks on the team?
Yeah, actually Allison did. So.
Oh, cool.
You saved the finance guy for when the deal's basically done. So.
Right.
Yeah, so. Well, I mean, you know, Alexis is, you know, he's recently come out as the spokesman for Unilever and Dove's, you know, parental leave campaign where they're sponsoring fathers with $5,000 grants when they don't have parental leave policies. So, you know, they are, you know, they really do embody kind of this new era of parents. And so I think, you know, they like the space, they like the mission. And so we kind of connected right away.
Interesting. What about, you know, what did you bring from your private equity background or thought process that maybe helped you raise money? Anything you took from those days?
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, understanding your cash flow is so important, right? So, you know, the biggest thing about raising money is not running out of time, So, you know, and inevitably, when you're doing it at the earlier stages, it'll take longer. And if it happens really quickly, be thankful but wary, because often founders will land money quickly and then they'll lock on a what I like to call a false consensus. So something they think makes the business work, but maybe it's not the bigger opportunity. So really just, you know, understand your cash flow, you know, your working capital, you know, how to be agile. And then really the second thing is growth. So, you know, growth is 1,000 pivots, right? So, you know, set your strategy and then just be very realistic about, you know, what's happening. So, cause you know, in the first couple, you know, I'd say that our overall strategy hasn't really changed since the day we started the business. but how we got there has really kind of evolved, you know, as we've grown the business. And so, you know, making sure that you're, you know, that you're constantly realistically pivoting, is just really, you know, one of the biggest pieces of advice that I can give.
Like what do you mean? Give an example of kind of constantly pivoting, or is it just experimenting with new things, or what?
Yeah. So for us, our initial, thought was that this was business was going to be focused on the return to work audience, you know, so 10 million educated women, you know, not currently participating in the workforce. And so, you know, when we were out raising money, you know, venture capitalists would actually look at that and then they say, okay, slice it by your function, slice it by your this. And then, oh, by the way, my wife is like incredibly educated and she was phenomenal when she worked, but I'm not 100% sure that she'd love to go back to a full-time job. And so I'm going to discount this a little bit further. And okay, now I think the addressable market is 1.5 million women, right? So while we knew that this market was huge, you know, with that positioning and with that narrative that we had about the business, you know, people were feeling like maybe it wasn't that big of an addressable market. But then as we were running the business, we knew it was different. So, and what really came forward was that, okay, so over 2/3 of the people that are actually, you know, on the platform and getting work are currently in the workforce. So this isn't just about, you know, bringing people back in, which is a critical piece of what we do. It's really about solving these larger topics for a broader audience and understanding that, and then understanding what that allowed us to do.
Yeah, good. What's it like working with your wife in a startup? That's kind of risky.
Yeah, I mean, my friend. You know, it's funny that you say that. So I've been in the startup since the beginning, but in the first year, you know, even though I had much more fundraising experience, I actively took a backseat. You know, part of it is this is really, you know, a mission based business, and Allison is the face, and there couldn't be a better face and a better representative for this mission. But another part of it, to be candid, is that, you know, family business is an uncertainty for an early investor. And, you know, while that may be unfair, you know, they're doing a formula that how many risk factors can I control? Right. And, you know, they know that the startup is going to be a grind, and that it's going to be really hard before it's good. And adding the layer of, of a family dynamic on top of that, you know, it's something that, you know, people are a little squeamish about. Now, there's so many examples of how it actually makes the startup stronger, and how that partnership and that trust and that problem solving really is an advantage. And so I'd like to consider us in that latter camp, but, you know, it wasn't great, the fact that I couldn't help more up front, you know? And that is a consideration that lots of couples who are looking at starting a business together have to be, you know, whether it's fair or not, just pragmatic about.
It's a lot of time together if you're working together, and yeah.
So and then here's the practical piece of advice: do not run the same parts of the business.
Sure.
Clear lanes. Have some clear lanes. So,
clear lanes. Yeah. That's good. Very good. Well, this is interesting. Anything you would do differently, or, you know, if you could go back and tell your younger self some fundraising advice that we haven't covered, any tips?
Yeah, I think, often, you know, people who are starting a concept, they've got, I don't know, $100,000 to $250,000 of budget that they've kind of marked to put against this. And you know, you've got to do so much with that. You know, you've got to build a product, you've got a proven market. You know, there's just, it's really not a lot of money to get to some strong proof points. I can share. So, we outsourced to an agency our MVP, and you know, and that ultimately was the wrong decision versus bringing in a technical partner, from the first day. So the logic goes, you know, once we had gotten to seed, you know, the type of full-time, you know, talent that we could attract into the business would be the type of resource that we, you know, would really need to take it to the next level. So while the product capabilities to get to that first proof point didn't merit it, you know, the reality is you're launching an untested product in the market. Like you don't get to just build it and then watch it go. and then build it later. Like, you have to be constantly building it, right? And it has to be constantly being built by someone who's got equal skin in the game as you. So, you know, in retrospect, we would have brought in, kind of a full-time technologist. In a story of, you know, the distance kind of paid off for us, luckily, we've recently just brought on, you know, a phenomenal technologist who was the founding technologist at a company called Expensify, who Allison had known for many years and basically spent 3 years trying to recruit. So, you know, for us, you know, getting to that stage, you know, really did pay off to get an exceptional technologist. But in that first year, we totally underestimated the need to have that person in. And the other thing I would say is, you know, don't start a business on your own. Just don't do it. You know, it's not smart. I had finance and operations and business scaling. She had commercial and sales. There's no way you can do those things. And then you should have a product person. So you really, you know, ideally would have three, you know, your CEO, head of sales, your head of technology and product, and then really your head of business, right? Because, you know, to kind of institutionalize rapid scale on a new business requires all three of those skill sets. And even if you are able to kind of do a lot of the overlap, you're not being realistic with yourself. So, I really would seek out founders. But then my caution to that is, don't seek out co-founders because of shared interest. You know, I've seen a lot of friends partner with people because, you know, the people were there, or it was convenient, or, yeah, you know, they were really into it. Right. And so that passion outweighed, you know, potentially a technical deficit. And, you know, it's hard when you can't pay full comp, right? Like, when you can't pay market comp, you need people who are making sacrifice and, you know, for the mission, right, in the early days. But you have to, you know, so if I'm going to unpack my advice, don't start the business on your own. Mm-hmm. You know, start it with founders who have unique skills, and then actually just be really brutal about what the right skill is. Mm-hmm. You know, so like, you could hire people who have the best backgrounds, but if they don't actually know how to build specifically what you're trying to build, it doesn't really matter. Mm. So just be very candid about, you know, what you actually think is needed, and have those people. And so that's just from a team side. And then from an investor side, you know, one thing that I didn't fully appreciate, to be candid, was the difficulty of raising, you know, angel and seed funds. So I came from a mid-market buyout fund, right? And so, you know, we did venture deals, but those deals typically started at B level, right? And so, you know, yeah, I had finance contacts. I was in the space. But really, you know, what angel investors or seed investors are looking for is they're looking for validation. And the founder really is the first thing they're testing. And the way that they really actually get comfortable testing the founder is when a super angel or somebody who actually gets it is in there, right? Has written that $100,000 check or that $250,000 check, you know, is making that introduction. So, you know, I think we could have gotten, you know, I don't know if super angel is the right term. We could have gotten that person in the mix earlier if we had been aware of it. Mm-hmm. It really wasn't until Eddie Liu, who is the founder of ShiftGig, which is another talent marketplace based out of Chicago, kind of came onto our board, and you know, helped communicate what we were doing to the investment community, that things really started to take off.
Mm, interesting. Yeah, that's a good strategy. Kind of spending a lot of your energy landing that one super angel or influencer or whatever you want to call it, before going out to the others. Good stuff. All right. Well, if people want to learn more, it's just themomproject.com, correct?
That is correct.
And anything you want to plug or announce or promote, or just
to people? Yeah. So two things, go to themomproject.com, create a profile of your talent. You know, everything is ultra confidential. You'll just be curated opportunities as you're matched. If your company, whether you've got, you know, 5 employees or 5,000, you know, go and create a profile, and you'll get access to incredible people that you will not have to make any payment on until literally the first day that they start working. And so it's really kind of a model that incentivizes getting back to work, getting the work done. And then the other thing that we're doing that's actually pretty exciting is called the Women's Work Initiative. So in 2018, we launched the Women's Work Initiative in Atlanta, and it was a public-private partnership with some of the largest companies there and the mayor's office, Honorable Keisha Lance Bottoms, who was a mother of two and new mayor in Atlanta. And so what we did is we partnered with AT&T, Georgia Pacific, Invesco, Voya, and others, worked with the mayor's office to get, you know, over 50 women back to work and to really create a blueprint for, you know, solving this $800 billion, you know, gender inequity challenge that we have nationally. And so this year we're rolling it out nationally with some really exceptional brands. And what we're doing is we're getting over 1,000 women back to work through this Women's Work Initiative, where we're really going to be highlighting the companies that participate and just helping everyone realize how to do this, you know, in a scalable way. So if this is interesting to you or interesting to someone that you know, please, you know, tell them to reach out to Nathan, get my information, or you can just go to themomproject.com. And the Women's Work Initiative is a tab on the top, and we'll reach out to you. So
perfect.
Thank you for that chance.
Yeah. All right. It's excellent. Well, congrats. Good job. And yeah, sounds great. Are there many men on the platform? You said it's not exclusively for women, but are there any real men on there?
Yeah. Oh, for sure. So we're an equal opportunity platform. So we obviously market to women, but once someone joins and bids, it's blind. So I'd say about 10% of the people on the platform are men, and a large percentage aren't mothers yet. So a lot of people either, you know, associate with the values, or, you know, they plan to have a family and they're in the process of trying to figure out, you know how to navigate it. So it really, you know, while we're called the Mom Project, and that really is, you know, what we embody, it's really for everybody.
Good. All right, Gregory, this is great. Thanks so much. Have a good rest of your week, and we'll catch you after your Series B. How about that?
Sure thing. Thanks, Nathan.
Cheers. Thank you.
Cheers.